Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you in partnership with our friends at Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much by going to airbnb.co.uk/host. So when I was in North Macedonia recently, I had a day where, a morning, where everything went terrifyingly wrong. I slept in and I didn't have enough time to have a coffee before I went out.
Okay.
And I don't think that's, and so I eventually had one at sort of 11:45 a.m.
I weep for you.
That was, I realized that the film Limitless is a love letter to caffeine, specifically coffee.
Right.
Because how Bradley Cooper's character feels when he is in withdrawal symptoms from NZT, the grayscale, the brain fog, the physical, it's exactly how I feel without coffee. And I'm being really careful because I'm concerned, like, this dependency I have on coffee. Like, am I dying? Mm. Is it bad? How many cups should you have a day? And every single article I look at, I'm well within the limit. I'm totally fine. Coffee, very good for the microbiome from what I hear.
Yeah.
But when he talks about that feeling of, like, everything, I was blind, but now I see. Mm. The world is clearer. Snap into focus. Conversation.
Caffeine does affect everyone differently, though, is what I will say.
Yeah.
There are some people who, they did a study, like, some people, their body can process it very quickly, and some people, it's still bouncing around their system 12 hours later.
I'm not one of the people who can do sort of espresso after dinner.
What? I can't do caffeine after four. Like, no way.
Two. Yeah, two. I really cut it off at two, with exceptions. If I've got a very long day or I'm working late, I will indulge.
Definitely but, no caffeine. No coffee after one. I might have a tea after two. Yeah. But
it's like I give myself, if I'm feeling a slump post-lunch, I'll allow it. Mm. But I'm like, what time are we?
Guys, we are so cool. We're so edgy. We don't have coffee after 2 o'clock.
And I know that like caffeine's meant to take 5 to 10 minutes to kick in, but there's definitely a placebo effect going on. Because when I tell you that first sip, my brain just goes, oh, boom.
Yeah.
It's immediate. Mm. And it's probably placebo. But who am I to deny that feeling? It's real to me, damn it.
I'm afraid to maybe even shoot an episode without you having caffeine. Like, it's Jekyll and Hyde.
Useless. It'd be useless. Literally.
Well, welcome. You join us in the morning, which is great. We love doing a morning episode. Mm. James has been caffeinated.
I'm very well and truly stocked up.
I was just telling James off air that I've reduced my tea intake this holiday. Not because I don't love it, but because I wake up, have my tea then. Very nice. Have my tea then. And then because
nobody loves tea more than me.
Just love with Italy. I've got a little stove pot, mocha pot, a little espresso after.
George, you're looking and sounding great. Like, you should go to Italy every other week.
I should do. We should just move there. Should I move here?
That's why. Let's do an Italy series.
I'd love that.
If any brand commissioner, streamer wants to just commission us, I'd reckon we need like 600K to do a few months production in Italy.
But talking about all the famous Italian movies.
Not a lot of money.
Just James and I put up. Just throw a couple of sponsorships, would be absolutely golden.
Let us know because we'll turn up. We'll really. Yeah.
We don't do anything half-assed.
Greece, also fine.
Greece. Anywhere hot.
France.
Hot. Anywhere, hot is good.
Yeah, chic, European.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 127 of Pulp Kitchen. If you haven't listened to last week's episode, we had a bumper episode. A little bit late, very sorry about that, but we reviewed Challengers, Baby Reindeer, and The Fall Guy. If you haven't listened to those yet, go check it out. We had a good old chat about that. This week, different episode. We've treated you to another editorial episode. Look at that.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice? We're going to be talking about the best directorial debuts of filmmakers. Mm. And we put this question out on Instagram, as we often do. Thank you so much for everyone's responses.
Okay,
we've compiled them here. We really, really appreciate it.
It's a really useful resource.
Yeah, you are...
George, the other week, we're like, we should just ask those like 60,000 people that follow us. Like, what are useful... it's like the size of Emirates Stadium. We're like, okay, everybody, can you all just let us know?
What a great focus group we have at our disposal. Thank you so much.
You know what we should do more? Polls and votes.
Yes.
Like, which is better? Would you you rather this person made this or this? Yeah. We should do more of that because it's great data.
It's great data. Thank you for providing us with your data in a non-spyware kind of TikTok China way.
Voluntarily given. Yeah.
We're recording this. The day that we're recording this right now is a Saturday. It's May the 4th, right? Yeah. Obviously, everyone's going, May the 4th be with you.
Sure.
And it reminded me of a TikTok that I saw that I wanted to talk about before we get into talking about debut film directors. It's, there was this TikTok that was talking about a conversation that had been happening on Twitter, and I think it was this screenwriter who was saying that this tweet had said, the problem with using The Simpsons as an example, it was talking about how all culture has kind of been flattened. It was like, the problem with the Simpsons as an example at the moment is that the people who, when The Simpsons was made but in the 90s at its peak in its original like first 10 seasons, it was made by people who brought loads of weird different experiences and sources and media and tastes together into a melting pot which created the Simpsons as a result, right? The problem is now is that the people who make The Simpsons grew up watching The Simpsons.
Right.
So it's just a copy of a copy, a simulacrum. And in this TikTok, this guy goes on to talk about that's the problem with Star Wars, right? If you look at the original Star Wars, that how George Lucas came to make that was really interesting, drawn like samurai movies, World War II dogfight footage, and abstract art. And then you get sort of Star Wars. The problem is now everyone who's making Star Wars projects grew up watching Star Wars. Ghostbusters, we talked about that recently. Ghostbusters is a really, if you think about the original Ghostbusters, the fact that it was not based on an existing IP.
It's a really strange, quirky tone. Even for its time, it's
what a strange
weird
movie. It's got, it's got a very odd sense of humor. It's about ghosts. It's set in current day, then contemporary New York.
The title doesn't match the tone of what that film is. No. Ghostbusters is quite a pulpy, flicked idea, but what it is different. To
it's
what the
way wackier.
Is, yeah.
But you only get that kind of film because Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis and Bill Murray coming together, bringing in their kind of kooky weirdness creates that. The problem with like the most recent Ghostbusters, which was rubbish, is because the people who made that, no disrespect to them, I mean like the people who commissioned that, I should say, just have grown up watching Ghostbusters. Yeah. They do that again. So it's this copy. And we're going to be talking about debut film directors today. And that's what's exciting about debuts when you watch them, is that those are filmmakers who have not had an impression placed on them yet by a greater force. They're bringing everything in their life, all their experiences, being as resourceful as they can be to do it. We talked recently about Dev Patel's Monkey Man. Yeah. Good, solid debut. And when I talked about that, I said it crackles with debut film energy. And that's what we're talking about. When you see something that's got a different voice and is exciting and isn't just a copy of a copy of a copy.
There's a similar conversation that happens within gaming, which is a very new medium, especially for storytelling. Originally, those consoles were marketed as toys to children. So inherently they were cartoony and also a byproduct of the technology available. They were cartoony, made for kids, toys, disposable. Those children then grew up loving video games and wanted to make video games as young adults. But their stories are a little bit immature and kind of, you know, if you look at like sort of the 80s and 90s, they're not the most like accomplished storytelling things. Yeah. All of those people then grew up, had children, got older, got divorced, lost parents. And all of these games now are about loss, fatherhood, being a mother, what it means to lose a parent, what it means to lose a partner, and they're always literally growing up because this medium is only 40 to 50 years old.
That's such the maturity of the medium.
Totally. And now you've got people who would have played different types of games that are now as accomplished as any great TV show, who want to change and completely re-narrativize how video games work, and you just see it grow up literally. The toy element is still there, that they are inherently toys, but now you talk about like digital art, storytelling in a digital medium. It, like that cycle point of reference and culture is changing within it, which has always been very interesting to see.
We're getting into it this week, guys. We really like it. We're getting into the deep topics, the things that matter behind the movies, taking a break from the movies, get behind the movies. Yeah. Anyway, let's get talking about the directorial debuts. Thanks for your input, guys, on Instagram. Let's get on with it.
Hey guys, this is a quick message brought to you in partnership with our friends at Airbnb.
James, the warmer months,
it's brighter.
Coming. It's spring, lighter. It's summer.
It's great.
Feel it.
Our show literally looks better because the light and the sun is out.
You can see it in our skin.
Yeah, we're happier.
We are happier.
We probably review things more favourably.
on a graph, we review it more favourably in the
Release
summer
stuff when the clocks go back, because we'll be better.
Clocks go forward.
Thank you.
As much as we do enjoy the show, James and I do need a break from each other. We are planning holidays away geographically away from each other.
Too much of you.
Necessary. I want to be in a different time zone to James.
Yeah.
But I love booking holidays. It's nice, exciting.
Got a nice little trip with the family to Corfu.
Oh.
Summer, very nice. We've actually booked an Airbnb to stay out in Corfu. And my sister is already, very organized as she is, she is hosting her London flat while we're away.
Smart.
She's very good.
Okay.
Puts that up very easy, makes a little bit of extra cash while she's away. And it's just really convenient.
That must be a pretty nice feeling to be on the beach with a pina colada, knowing that you're getting a little bit of extra cash from hosting your home back home.
Drinks on her.
Lovely.
Yeah. And then I actually looked at what other flats in my area were going for. And I thought, oh, I should definitely look into this. I just think it really makes sense, especially if you're traveling a lot for work. Mm. You go on the occasional holiday. It's a really easy step to make a little bit of extra cash that really just makes sense if you haven't done it already.
Yeah, I have heard about hosting before on Airbnb. I've never done it, but all the people that have told me about it are people like me. So I often think, why don't I do it? Well, if you guys are interested in hosting, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much by going to airbnb.co.uk/host. So, the best ever directorial debuts from a filmmaker. We love it when we see a directorial debut. And I want to begin by just talking about, first of all, the people's vote. We asked people on Instagram, what's the best debut from a filmmaker?
Yeah.
Overwhelmingly, and not surprisingly, because it was a very recent example, but the number one film that came to people's minds was Celine Song's Past Lives.
Film of last year.
Film that we loved last year. Pulp Kitchen film of 2023.
Yeah.
We loved it. We talked about it extensively. We don't need to talk about it
much
more.
Go and check out our reviews for gushing
praise. Our reviews,
our
spoiler cast. It's all there. We loved it. But yes, Celine Song made a very, very, very accomplished film. And Celine Song, who had a very
extensive theatre director background, so obviously not just immediately picked up a camera and looked at art and made something.
Yes, and it's worth saying
that... Don't get too disheartened about the people who've made their directorial debut.
A lot of these filmmakers who've made their debuts, you know, draw on a lot of existing experience, either in television or as being an actor or making a lot of short films. And there are actually three technicalities I want to point out with names that were suggested to us.
Rules.
There are some rules here, guys. So first of all, Frank Darabont, his first feature film was technically The Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
Congrats to you, Frank Darabont,
well done.
That film definitely endures.
Solid.
However, technically, he'd already made a TV movie before that. He'd worked in TV a lot, but he'd already made a TV movie. Mm. So it's a little bit of a... Sidney Lumet, similarly, everyone said 12 Angry Men, great debut. I'm like, yes, but he'd also made a TV movie before that called The Challenge.
Because when we discussed the idea of doing this, we quickly looked at what Google threw up and those films were there. I'm like, damn, 12 Angry Men,
yeah,
is that
very
first one? But without having done a single bit of research.
A lot of people suggested Greta Gerwig and I'm like, I love Lady Bird and I know it feels like a debut and it is like the new Greta Gerwig that we associate with, the Greta Gerwig we know.
Has debut energy.
Absolutely, definitely has debut film energy, but technically she co-directed a feature film in 2008 with Joe Swanberg called Nights and Weekends. So it's like that does matter because you're bringing with you all this experience of making a particularly a feature film. And there's actually a huge disqualification for one. I'm really sad about this because I was gearing up to talk about a debut film that I love and everyone has suggested. But lo and behold, the film that I have to disqualify is Damien Chazelle for Whiplash.
No.
Whiplash is not his debut film. His debut film is a film called Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench from 2009. Admittedly, I think he made it when he was in film school, but still, it's a feature-length movie. I'm afraid that counts. Don't get me wrong, we love Whiplash. And actually, can I just take a brief point on Whiplash? This is a tangent, but I've been thinking about Whiplash recently and that, you know, that's a film that...
It's your Roman Empire.
No, it's not my Roman Empire, but, you know, a lot of people... You love it, I love it. A lot of people really hide that, and that's a film we can revisit a lot. I do have get the feeling that Whiplash is for our generation, will be for our generation in a few decades' time, what The Godfather is for our parents' generation, right?
Right.
So hear me out.
I kind of see where you're going with that,
We like The Godfather. Yeah. It's a good movie, but we don't go immediately to calling it our favourite film.
We didn't feel a duty to tell people how good The Godfather was.
Whereas like my parents' generation, literally my parents, it's their favourite movie, The Godfather. Yeah. And with Whiplash, I just get the feeling that if you speak to anyone in a sort of broad age bracket of us, sooner or later when you're talking about film, they'll go, oh yeah, well, Whiplash is fantastic.
Because it came out the age that our tastes were maturing too.
And it's very, very good.
It's really
and
good.
It's endlessly rewatchable. And for me, it's Damien Chazelle's best film still. He's made some good films, but that is still my favourite film of his. And it's in my favourite films. And I know it's very popular and it's a little bit film bro-y, but I get the feeling that that's going to be the one in like people telling their kids like, you see movies? Well, you haven't seen Whiplash from 2015? Yeah. Oh, you got to go see that.
And it's so easy to jump in and watch that and come out with just beaming with joy at how good it is. It's very easy to recommend that film. It's quite universal in that sense.
Although I told Anna that I had that idea and she was like, that's funny because I have no desire to rewatch that movie and I've not really thought about it. Yeah. And I was like,
I reckon I've seen it three times, maybe four.
Yes, yeah,
it's really, really good.
What I love about Whiplash is it's like a Swiss watch. The mechanics of it, again, as it's not a debut film, but still from a very young filmmaker, give him credit there. Yeah. And it is very tight. Yeah. The tightness of it is like a Swiss watch. I just love seeing how you can make a film with that speed and that tension on a short time frame, like a 90-minute movie.
And it doesn't look crazy expensive as well. It's mostly shot in small, dark rooms. Yeah. Where like the drama between two characters is the highlight. There's no spectacle really apart from the music itself, which if you know how to shoot that, that's just basically taken for granted.
Those were the
You're not getting in it, but you got a very good discussion.
Yeah, well done, Jamie Giselle.
It doesn't count. We'll give you your roses anyway.
Okay, first one to talk about. It's a huge one from like a few years ago. Jordan Peele, Get Out. Now, Jordan Peele had a very successful career in television as a sketch, as comedy writer, sketch comedy, and performer. Anyone who's seen Key and Peele, very funny sketches, but also incredibly cine-literate, intelligent, well-crafted sketches.
Totally.
So the leap from him to being a filmmaker makes a lot of sense.
And I really think doing sketch comedy for that long a time, learning how to make a really concise story with reference points that are familiar to people over and over and over again by pure attrition storytelling within 2 to 5 minutes, regardless of the genre, I think that you come out of that experience really sharp.
Yeah,
and probably actually desperate to go and make something longer than 6 minutes. You're like, I would love to see what I could do with months of filming instead of just a day.
That's it. Yeah, you have to train under constraints.
Yeah.
It's you know what it is? It's that old adage, which is necessity is the mother of invention.
Yes.
Where if you've only got 6 minutes to tell something, it makes you incredibly essentialized.
Yes.
So when you go to make a 90-minute movie, oh, brilliant. I know how to be clean.
And like it's a classic transition of like comedy actor, performer, director moving into something much darker and making that bit seemingly being so seamless.
Twisting his sense of humor into something a lot more deep, you know, cutting and deeper and sinister. Yeah. But as a debut film, what a success it was.
Huge.
Not only was it, you know, very, you know, box office success, it started a cultural conversation because the success of Get Out is not just that it's a very effective thriller, it's that it also penetrates a deeper conversation.
I really remember the buzz around it coming out, the hype, the fantastic poster, the black and the white, the bright white eyes. And was there one of just his eye as well?
There was a teaser one that was just the band of his
that
eye.
That was it,
You know, the American poster is a lot more generic. It's like a gunshot with a cracked glass and it's like blue. But the UK one was really...
Yeah, on the
really,
chair, the sink into the floor scene.
We don't talk about them often because it's a podcast. It's basically an audio-led medium, but we do love movie posters.
Yes,
and we would happily talk about...
Yes.
If you guys would like to hear us talk about movie design of posters, we might do it, but it's a visual thing.
Similarly, like we'd love to do an episode on scores, but I think we can't just insert scores of films without it being like a copywriting issue thing, which for an audio podcast would be lovely. It's kind of thing that like the BBC would get to do.
Yes, the BBC.
If the BBC want to give us a show,
and
we could just like, the commissioners could just comply all of the scores we want to put in. I'd love to do a 2-hour long special going through the great scores.
Fantastic. So Jordan Peele, fantastic. I think he got some Oscar nominations as well. I think he might have even won the best screenplay, but what a great transition from drawing on your experience and building something new. And the great thing about Jordan Peele as well, is that he's continued to make
relevant, exciting films
and has become an auteur that we return to. I look forward to seeing Jordan Peele movies.
Totally.
And back, you know, like you were talking off air like about Monkey Man. He backed Monkey Man as a
really nice to see that. Like if you've got capital and sway in the industry to do what you want. And I love that if like over 10 years ago I said, you'd never guess which comedian would transition into filmmaking on the biggest, most exciting scale, culturally relevant. You just wouldn't have guessed that. And I love that someone can just shift and make a really great impact on the industry that they love.
A couple of other ones, a recent example, Charlotte Wells for After Sun, a bit like Past Lives, a good tight movie that kind of burst out, very much a breakout hit. What I love about After Sun, which is a movie you and I both like.
Yeah, I really liked it.
But I remember watching the ending of After Sun, the sort of finale of it, which is really powerful, really profound. And I remember thinking, that's a fresh voice coming through there. I can't wait. You get excited to think, I can't wait to see what this person does next.
Yeah. I like that it looks distinctively cheap and not in a bad way.
Yeah,
that's part of its charm, of its new film energy, is that you know it isn't trying to outdo itself in production. When you need to make a film about textures, sounds, smells, voices, people, skin, That sensuality is very easy to capture. It does sometimes feel like we were just with them with a camera, seeing what they could pick up.
I think when we'll talk about this, I guess when we go through the other ones, but like, I do think the key to a good debut is like you are working under that slight constraint as well. It's different if you're like with Get Out, you're drawing on previous experience as a storyteller.
Yeah.
But I think that if you're honing your craft as a storyteller for the first time, it does sometimes actually aid you to be working in a constrained environment.
Yeah. It's like, I love Oppenheimer and it's brilliant. It's a feat of filmmaking, but that film is only exists as a byproduct of an accomplished director's seventh plus film. You do not get to make the chance to make films with that talent, that budget, that cinematography. Love that it's there.
That's 20 years of work.
That's not first film energy.
No. That's career high
it's,
energy.
It's totally like Killers of the Flower Moon equivalent. That's not what maketh.
Only a director as, you know, in his seventh decade or whatever, eighth decade as Martin Scorsese could make that kind of movie.
But in 1 year, you and I can hold up Killers of the Flower Moon and Past Lives, and they can be in the same conversation for Film of the Year, despite that, which is what's so exciting.
That's a really good point. A couple of other ones. Alex Garland, Ex Machina, a film you love.
Really brilliant. I think I'm really due a rewatch. It's a film that is wonderfully dense and knotty and way more interesting than you give it credit for in its first watch. I remember liking it when I first saw it, rewatching it, and just thinking like, wow, this is brilliant. And it's so much fun to jump online and YouTube essays all about it and the theories. There's a wonderful sort of aligning of the stars. You've got three actors who I think at that moment in time in 2014, 2015 were just on their real rise to fame, doing really interesting work, and are now sort of very accomplished. And it just brilliant performances. It's shot in a really cool way. Love the design of the AI, the translucent spider web design of it. Just brilliant.
Yeah, I've only seen it once. I'd love to rewatch it again. But I do love Oscar Isaac, Donald Gleeson, Alicia Vikander just together. Like
really strange visually performance from Oscar Isaac at that time, like doing something very different with how he expressed himself. And I don't think Alex Garland has quite got to the highs of Ex Machina since, which is a shame. Did you say when you saw Civil War, he sort of potentially taking a break from directing?
He didn't say it at that point, but there had been an article that was circulating online. But I think it's been slightly taken out of context. But basically, yes, I think he had intimated that in the near future, he might not direct something. He might not direct a movie immediately after Civil War, basically. Yeah. He might be taking... But as he pointed out, he was like, I'm still going to be a filmmaker because even if I'm writing, that is filmmaking.
Yeah. Alex Garland, in all his films, I think he's got a really great... He really understands how to direct tension, whether that's in horror or like sort of real boiler point of getting characters in the same space, really tense with each other. And he is still a voice, I think. You have a dark, scary mind, and I'd like to keep hearing what you have to say in film.
Can I just jump forward to dark, scary, actually, since you just said dark and scary?
Please.
A genre that is often brilliant for directors to try to sink their teeth into is horror, right? Mm. And, you know, horror, it's quite you can effectively do a horror well on a low budget. You can, you know, it's amazing how on little you can scare people. And actually, sometimes we've said that some of the best horror films are restrained, are low budget, because
Paranormal Activity, for example, one of the most profitable films ever made.
Yes.
Regardless of what you think of the quality of its sequels, spawned and repopularized found footage.
That's also why, actually, in a way, talking about like
Blair Witch
the cultural
Project
flattening,
as well, too.
That's why when a studio sanctioned horror film comes out, I'm always a bit like, that doesn't look very scary, because it's just sort of bloated. But when a self-produced independent horror film comes out, it's interesting. And I mentioned that for two films. One is a film that we love on this show, which is Barbarian.
Oh,
Zach Cregger, again, had an extensive career in television, and like Jordan Peele, had a background in comedy and sketch comedy. And that really comes through in Barbarian, which is funny and dark and twisted.
Yeah.
But that's a really great, exciting movie, and we talked about, you know, directors having their own voice. That film has such a specific tone to balance the horror and the comedy.
Yeah,
it's brilliant. But the other one as well I wanted to shout out was Jennifer Kent with The Babadook.
Yeah,
which again,
scary film,
effectively very scary, but also manages to be about something deeper, about loss, about grief.
It totally elevates it from being just another scary film to something you're very happy to recommend to horror fans. Like, if you haven't seen The Babadook, really, really delivers on scares and deep and meaningful.
And similarly, I mean, this isn't a straightforward horror film, but Shaun of the Dead for Edgar Wright.
Oh,
right? I mean,
God.
Edgar Wright, had a successful career at that point. He made two seasons of Space. He'd done a lot of TV things, but this was his first feature film. And you know, it's hard to get made. I remember Simon Pegg telling a story about, you know, that movie never almost didn't happen because it's like a low budget zombie comedy. But that, again, Shaun of the Dead, the reason that film is great is not just that it's really funny. It is really, really funny, but it's because it's genuinely quite scary at
it's
times.
It's a spoof film, but it's probably the best, most highly regarded spoof film ever made, and it's not necessarily spoofing anything in particular versus just itself,
just a genre, just the whole genre as one. Really
think about like the scary movie films at the time, but this was so stylistic and so well done and so memorable and rewatchable as well.
Oh, it's so good. I always do you have a preference between Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz?
Hot Fuzz is my favorite of the two. I do prefer Hot Fuzz. I've seen Hot Fuzz more times.
I think probably Hot Fuzz has got more quotes in it. You can just drop out and, you know, drop into conversation. I don't know what
you're talking about. And just sorry, I just mentioned found footage, but like the Blair Witch Project as well, in terms of that element that is very much lost now because the internet is the beast that it is, of is this real?
Yes.
No, it's real. I swear to God, bro, it's a real story. And it was so grounded and realistic, and it's shot on a potato.
Yeah.
It just brilliant. And so I don't think that could ever really happen again in that way.
You know, that is actually probably the best example of what you can do with a low budget independent horror film.
Yeah.
I mean, what I love about the scares in Blair Witch, it's not about individual scary moments. It's about the latent sense of dread and fear and paranoia. Yeah. It taps into the primal fear of being lost in a forest. And what I love is when it gets to the end, the final sort of punch is out of context, not scary at all. But when you see it in this film, because you know what you've been told and informed by the whole movie, it's real bone-chilling, spine-chilling moment.
It's like great horror. It's the idea of what is scary is scarier than what you're seeing. Because on screen, it's like snot in a tent. Because they probably didn't have the money. All they could show was heavy breathing in a tent. Maybe like a hand printing on. Or is it a face that goes into the tent? I can't remember.
I think it's lots of hands pushing on the tent, which was just the crew.
All of us. And someone's brother. But the idea of something being outside and the sticks on the ground, and that just really well done.
And I think The Witch is also, wasn't that Robert Eggers' first movie?
Is it his first movie? I can't confirm. Stand by.
Yeah, Robert Eggers' first, technically his first feature film was The Witch.
Deeply unsettling.
Deeply.
Ralph Ineson with his voice.
Again, that's a movie
Let
with
that be upon us.
Only three very, very profoundly strong scares.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is, you know.
Goats.
It is. Sometimes I was like, yeah, the perils of animal husbandry in the 1600s.
It's one of those, like, you trip and fall on a stick and just slightly puncture your skin. That's
it.
Yeah. Thanks for playing.
What happened to Gary? Well, he grazed his knee and then what? Well, he died of scurvy.
Done.
Moving away from horror now, again, we've talked about people who've drawn on backgrounds in comedy, but a film from a director who's only made one movie and a debut film is Bo Burnham with Eighth Grade. Like, what a great, lovely movie that was.
So good, yeah.
Really well-exercised, executed movie about, you know, the anxious feeling of being 13. Mm. And if anyone hasn't seen it, they must. It's funny, it's really good heart. And the filmmaking, you know, we're talking about them as filmmakers. The filmmaking is very good. There's a central scene where she has to go to a pool party, and the music that is used, it really captures the paranoia and tension of being in that moment when you feel like everyone is looking at you. You're in a swimming costume that just does not suit your body because your body is changing.
Yeah.
Everyone's very awkward and gawky. It's a really great movie.
I've said this a few times before. I think it's the best film, or actually the only film that I think really understands how to capture the internet and what's going on there. I think for a really long time, the internet, it's not a very inherently cinematic thing to capture because it's filming a screen or even a phone, which I think is hard to make relevant to people who are watching a screen, or you're having this digital overlay, which dates. And for a long time, well, the internet is new and social media is new. Mm. For a long time, I don't think filmmakers want to touch exactly what's going on behind that screen or even understand themselves how to address this new way of experiencing other people's lives through social media. And then you go and watch Eighth Grade and you're like, that is such a great articulation of how the internet affects someone who has grown up with a phone screen in their hands.
Totally, yeah, it's about their experience of it, their first-hand lived experience of being... I mean, I remember with Eighth Grade, Elsie, we're shown that her burgeoning desire, her pubescent sexual awakening, is she's experiencing
through
that
through the lives of others,
through her phone, in the way that she sort of cyber, not stalks, but, like, you know, checks in on the hot guy in her class.
Which is something everyone does, like looking at other people online.
And it's kind of vague. She sort of like kisses her finger, then kisses the glass, and it's kind of like this, but yeah, burgeoning sexual desire. And I'm like, that's a really brilliant way of capturing that experience.
Yeah, and just like, I feel like would you more content on the impact of films, sorry, on the impact of social media in lifestyle? It's such a dominant and prevalent piece of marketing, information, news, social experience. Like, even in The Social Network, it's quite light on what they're actually inventing. There's moments when Mark Zuckerberg is like, we're calling it the wall.
They're
sort of coming up with these ideas, and you take the entire social experience of college and put it online. And that film is all about the drama of, you know, who owns Facebook. Yeah. But there's so much more to be said about this world that we're living in, how we're experiencing information and giving it to our children. And that film's just really good at doing that. But Bo Burnham also talks very articulately as himself
about
social media and the impact it has, and how basically he thinks it's a really big problem.
And anyone, again, who hasn't seen Inside, which he did, his comedy special.
Go watch Inside. Hilarious.
Which is like one of the stand-up pieces of COVID art, I think, that people will look back at and go, oh, that was that captures and reflects.
It's so much more than a standard Netflix comedy special. It's brilliant. And very cinematic as well.
Very cinematic.
He shot it all himself.
And inventive. It's all about being inventive.
Really inventive. I remember I didn't like. I knew who Bo Burnham was for a very long time, but I was never a huge fan of his. And then when our school took us to the Edinburgh Fringe in 2013, and they paid for one of like the Friday night shows to take us all to, and then we all just went amongst ourselves. But the show they brought us was to go see Bo Burnham's What, which, if you've seen that show, is a phenomenal live show. And I remember thinking, oh yeah, that'll be fun. I like Bo Burnham, internet video guy. Watch that live show, and I just came out of it thinking, holy mother of God, that guy is seriously talented. Like, tight, concise, hilarious. And his work consistently has gotten darker and more meaningful, talks a lot about depression, anxiety in his comedy, but always so funny.
You know what's funny is that, like, Anna busted out a Bo Burnham reference the other day that really caught me off guard. Because I was like, we were talking about Taylor Swift, actually, and I was like, do you like this song? Do you like this song? And I was like, do you like this song? And she said, no, that's a bit too much of a repeat stuff. I was like, oh, yeah, Bo Burnham, very accurate. He's talking about pop music.
I really like Make Happy, by the way. The final song where he takes the piss out of Kanye West doing the auto-tune song. And he talks about, like, making a burrito, and it's all a metaphor for mental health and taking on too many things. It's really good. And then he's like, I can't perform anymore. Thank you. Good night. I hope you're happy. Drops the mic, and then he's not done a live show since.
Yeah.
He's not done a live show since. He was just like, I'm done. Bye. This is too much. I'd love him to do another live show.
I'm going to fire off quick fire now some remaining names, if that's right. If you want to give some sort of quick reactions to that,
sure.
Is that okay? Because we've just got a big number of names here.
Nice.
We've talked about this before. Neil Blomkamp, District 9.
Oh, yeah. Impactful. Again, talking about impact of found footage in 2009 and how big that was in telling a story. Amazing central performance from, remind me,
Charlton Copley.
Yes.
And I think that's his first screen role as well. Yeah.
And like, it's similar to a Christoph Waltz. You discover this actor in this great film and like, where the hell's this guy been forever?
And I said this when he's in Monkey Man, and I'm like, I would like to see him in more stuff, Charlton Copley, because he can play sort of weird menacing very well. Even though he's not a menacing character in District 9, he's actually very good at being kind of weird and wild.
I want to give credit to District 9. I've only seen this film once, but the visual effects for the time, I remember totally feeling totally real and really felt like dirty and lived in and in that environment, really felt part of the world, despite it being like a mother ship over the slant, like, just very, really well done.
Not special effects that, you know, instead of being isolated to a specific scene, were just built into the, as you say, into the environment so well.
Which probably helps when you add motion blur of camera shake. And it's probably a lot easier to pull off that effect. Yeah, District 9, totally.
Citizen Kane, Orson Welles, first movie, he was 26. And he has made, in many people's eyes, one of the best movies of all time. It is the Citizen Kane
tops
of movies.
Many lists.
Yeah, it's in there. Have you seen Citizen
Kane? No, okay. I've only
seen it once, but I did think when I watched it, I was like, this is pretty good.
Pretty good. Yeah.
And I did think some of the filmmaking was really inventive and really strong. And I know some people think it's overrated, but I thought it was pretty good. The fact that he's 26 but talks like a 48-year-old man, hello, I'm Orson Welles, is very, very bizarre. But he wrote it, directed it, acted in it, produced it.
Wrote
it's
the tune,
proper auteur movie.
Yeah.
And he was 20 bloody six. So Good on you, Orson.
Bradley Cooper wishes.
Bradley Cooper could never.
Yeah. I love you, Bradley Cooper.
I love you.
I know you're listening. I don't want you to.
We love. Oh, we love Bradley Cooper. I truly believe you will make a great movie.
Yeah.
It's just not the one you think it is. It's not Maestro. Yeah,
it's true.
It's gonna come. A couple of 90s examples. I've never seen it, but Wes Anderson for Bottle Rocket. Nice. Noah Baumbach's first movie, Kicking and Screaming, is actually really charming. Really, really nice. Mm. The lead actor in that plays the dad in Eighth Grade, actually.
Just nice. That.
Obviously, Quentin Tarantino, Reservoir Dogs.
Well, I mean, yeah.
What else is there to say? Everyone says that.
But, yeah, and Quentin Tarantino for a long time talked about trying to make a film, failing, realizing very late in the process, being very disheartened by it. But he was just very much a sort of, fuck it, I'm going to go again and go for it.
And what's the common thread? Limited locations, tight cast. No women in that movie.
No, like, I mean, not a woman.
I guess it's the... I mean, come on.
That's all a real shame about Lord of the Rings is those women do not get a voice in that film.
The same with There Will Be Blood.
Phenomenal. Like, yeah. I think there's phenomenal movies, but yeah.
Somebody pointed out they love Rian Johnson's Brick. I've only seen that once. I need to rewatch that again, but I've heard people really, really champion that. Yeah. Look, Guy Ritchie has made a real mixed bag of movies, but...
If you just sort of, like, forget everything post-2010...
If you post... Lock, Stock and Snatch. So Lock, Stock is the debut film he made, and then Snatch afterwards. Lock, Stock and Snatch, I think I can stand by those movies.
And I would credit them with genuinely having a lasting impact on British cinema. I don't even say American cinema since they came out.
The Geezer
they
movies.
Genuinely, Geezer. No. Yeah. See, that's where you're wrong. A really genuinely impactful presence on cinema forever. You cannot take that away from him.
And, he's made some mixed stuff afterwards and sometimes become a bit of a parody of himself. But those two original young Guy Ritchie movies, or Lock, Stock even, as a debut film. I think I've seen Snatch more, but Lock, Stock is really... Also, actually, if you look at his IMDb, he makes Lock, Stock and that pretty much catapults him into doing big, big movies for the rest of his career. He doesn't have a sort of hanging around the low point. He does Lock, Stock, then he does Snatch, which has Brad Pitt in it and an American budget behind it. Then he... just swept away. He marries Madonna for a little bit.
And there's loads of great stories about how he got that tone and that accuracy of gangster life by genuinely talking to gangsters and getting their anecdotes and their stories for the crazy things that happened and putting it on screen. Like, that's fun and exciting.
Danny Boyle's first movie, Shallow Grave, is really good. I know you haven't seen it, but that's also funny, dark, limited to one location. If you love Trainspotting, you'll like Shallow Grave. Nice. A lot of the ingredients carry over. It's not a great movie, but it was a solid debut. Was Olivia Wilde with Booksmart?
Yeah,
have you seen it?
No, I'm sorry, I've seen it. It's been on my iPad for a plane for a long
it's
time.
It's a very good plane watch. It's a shame because when Don't Worry, Darling came out, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, like a new director. Oh no, it's a shame. But for Booksmart,
and probably jumped up to like big. I don't know, like the budget is bigger and the idea is bigger and the cast was bigger. Sorry.
No, but I think my only thing with Booksmart, I was disappointed that. I went in expecting like a Lady Bird movie and then it turned out to be a very studio-based comedy. It's quite generic, but I was very happy with how Olivia Wilde, even though it's quite generic, made it her own thing. We've mentioned that person. Oh, Spike Jonze, who obviously was massive, cut his teeth hugely in the 90s with the Beastie Boys and cutting music videos, iconic music video director. His first... feature film was Being John Malkovich. Have you ever seen that?
No.
Being John Malkovich is one of those... I love Being John Malkovich.
It's also on my iPad in my backlog.
It's one of those ones that's just so strange and so bizarre. It should not work, but it's really good and really funny. And Malkovich doing... Malkovich, talking about the premise of this film is so stupid. It's a movie in which...
It's amazing that it got to happen.
Do you even know the exact premise of
it? No, not really.
John Cusack... also an unrecognizable John Cusack and an unrecognizable Cameron Diaz. The first time I saw it, it took me half the movie before I realized it was her. He plays a down and out guy who ends up working in this office department, which is on the 9.5 floor. And it's in a floor where the ceilings are low. It's written by Charlie Kaufman. So everything's slightly weird. Yeah. But he discovers a door that when you go into it, allows you to be in the headspace of the actor, John Malkovich, for 15 minutes. And then after which you are ejected onto a corner of the New Jersey Turnpike, out on the motorway.
It should never have been made.
It should never have worked. But I'm so glad it does. It's a brilliant debut.
I'd like to just throw in Tom Ford's a single man. He's only made two films. I've said this many times. I'm his biggest fan. I'd love another film. I hear he's writing one. Please make more.
And that's a movie that isn't constrained or restrained.
No.
And draws on... But he's drawing on such an interesting background and experience in fashion.
Yeah, in terms of like artistic creation, if you don't know, Tom Ford was sort of retook over the remade Gucci into what it was, eventually made his own brand, which was Tom Ford, spun off into filmmaking. His films are stunning pieces of production art. I'd love a coffee table. I think there is a fashion coffee table book of Tom Ford that's very famous, but I'd love the cinematic coffee table book of his fine stills from his films and liftings from the concepts. He makes beautiful, beautiful clothes and films.
He's a beautiful man as well, really.
Tom Ford.
He's also got a very
sexy
voice.
Nobody's ever seen the dark side of my face. He really has a side of his face, and in interviews, you'll never see the other side.
You think you're listening to Stanley Tucci, but it's a much deeper, more younger.
There are some really great videos of like Tom Ford style guides for men on like these basics that you should do. It's like, find a sport that you love and play it once a week. Socks. Buy new socks every month. There's no need to have old socks. They're really good pieces of advice, but they're really funny. And he's got a great sense of humor. Just love it. Great brand, Tom Ford as well. Can't afford any of his stuff.
Oh, no.
It's like heinously expensive.
If Tom Ford would like to sponsor this show, absolutely. For the rest of time, we will be here in black wraparound sunglasses. Yes.
He does these amazing like shearling jackets for about £9,000. A gorgeous poplin shirt would be about 800 quid.
We could afford to wear one of those jackets for about 5 minutes, and then you have to hand it back.
I wear his perfume though. Very nice.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Is that what I smell?
Not currently, no.
Or is that the kimchi that you had? Yes,
Italian kimchi.
Those were just some of the many names that people suggested, and some of our favourites too. Yeah. But if there's any we've missed out, let us know if there are any directors that you think did really great debut films.
Yeah.
Obviously, you've got the entire history of cinema there. I mean, I haven't mentioned, there's a great movie from the 50s called Night of the Hunter, which they're actually remaking, which is like a noir horror. An evil preacher stalks these children because he wants this money, right? And it was Charles Laughton, who was an actor, his only film, and then he died. It was the only film he ever made. It was really, really good. It still holds up.
I wonder if we should talk about follow-ups, like the second album, but the sophomore films.
We could do a, guys, if you enjoyed this discussion today, if you want to see the best second films, what did the big directors who had a great debut success, do next?
Almost there, because I'd argue like Nocturnal Animals is better than A Single Man for Tom Ford.
But it's like,
what did they warm up with? Mm. And what did they go, hello, I'm here, I learn, I'm back.
Like Memento.
Oh yeah, great shout. Memento. Also,
about to say La La Land, but as we've discussed, that's not his second film. It's his first film.
And Memento has debut film energy, even though I know it's not. It's Insomnia and Following. That's but the flash, feel of it.
No. Insomnia comes after Memento.
Does it?
Memento's 2000, Insomnia 2002, Batman Begins 2005, Prestige 2006, Dark Knight 2008, Inception 2010, Dark Knight Rises 2012, Interstellar 2014, Dunkirk 2017, Tenet 2020, and Oppenheimer 2023.
Dark Knight Rises. Interstellar within 2 years.
Yeah.
Quite a good turnaround to make Interstellar.
He looks like someone who doesn't waste time, Christopher Nolan. He's a very efficient
man. He doesn't
own
a smartphone, so there's no TikTok going on.
I also know that if I ever had a conversation with him, I would be sweating because if I paused or stammered or give any sort of wasted time, he would be thinking, okay.
They're not working.
I'm going to drop you because not because I don't like you, but because my time is valuable. I'm thinking up my next movie right now.
I am having this conversation both forward and backward at the same time. So he's just done. He's got received the highest praise and financial acclaim for Oppenheimer. Yeah. Do you think he's gone on holiday with his lovely wife Emma Thomas, who produces this film? Or do you think he's now his walls? Do you think he's time dilated?
Like, how do you celebrate a victory like that with Christopher Nolan? Do you sit on your sofa and eat a bag of Cheetos for like 2 weeks and just be like, I can do whatever I fucking want?
Because that I think of all the praise that a film could receive and accolades, Oppenheimer has received the highest.
It's the Holy Trinity.
Your actors won the best. You won the best. Your film won the best.
It's also, it's the Holy Trinity of financially acclaimed, financial success, critically acclaimed, and awards acclaim, right?
He's not been cancelled after the fact. He's good.
He's blank check moment. He'll got a carte blanche moment to do whatever. I mean, he's had that for a while, but whatever he does next, I mean.
He'll have woken up to like not another 9 figures in his bank account from that film.
What interesting point for an artist to be at.
To be fair, he's made very financially successful, critically acclaimed films, but you're here now. You've done it.
I think that is what, sorry, we've gone on a tangent about Christopher Nolan, but that is what makes him one of the most interesting filmmakers is that he's been able to be an auteur filmmaker who makes Christopher Nolan films.
Smart films.
But yeah, while not make films on his terms, while simultaneously bringing in financial success and audience appeal. Like, that is a very unique thing. It's not this sort of radical, tyrannical director who burns bright and then makes a massive flop and everyone abandons them. That's quite, kind of the trajectory that used to happen in the 70s.
His work post Dark Knight is, I think, where he really kicks into gear, because that gave him the blessing and the confidence from anyone else to let him make Inception. Mm. He's like, I've wanted to make Inception. I've been thinking about Inception for 10 years, but I had to make The Dark Knight so I could make Inception.
I wonder if he'll make... Does Nolan do small? Could he go and do a smaller film now if he just said, I'm actually going to make the fourth film in the Before trilogy? It's actually going to cut back and forth in their mind, but really it's going to be two people in a room over a ham sandwich.
Or like if he did something like a spiritual successor to When Harry Met Sally.
Wow, that would throw us off.
Do you know?
He's going to remake Shallow Hal. Who do you cast as your lead in the remake of Shallow Hal?
So if it's not...
It would have been Jack Black and Gwyneth Paltrow.
First of all, you gender flip it. That'd be the modern thing as well.
Yes.
It would be the man who would be the...
Very correct.
So the woman would be, rom-com lead now, probably Sydney Sweeney.
Yeah, but I think funnier than Sydney Sweeney.
Okay.
Even though Jack Black's not like crazy hilarious in that film.
Who's a good female comedic lead?
Who's the one from Booksmart?
Beanie Feldstein?
Yeah.
Or Caitlin Dever?
I think Beanie Feldstein.
She's great. She's really good.
You could get her in like Shallow Hal.
The guy would have to be...
It has to be a really good looking guy, because the reveal is that they're actually... overweight. Yes, if we're still doing size thing, right?
And they're in a massive... Because it was Gwyneth Paltrow in the original, wasn't it, right?
So you get Timothée Chalamet.
You get Timothée Chalamet.
It's
like, he's like a stick.
No, it'd be Paul Mescal.
Paul Mescal.
And directed by Christopher Nolan. I'd love to see it.
That'd be great.
People would just queue up.
Well, the idea of sort of the reverse mind body dysmorphia is something that I've thought about for a very long time. And
you truly believe that he is... A god, you know, Adonis god.
Imagine, like, he calls up Cillian Murphy to read a red printed script. It's like this big Shallow Hal 2.
Okay, yeah. If you didn't like that, I've also got Crocodile Dundee reboot in the back. He's got all these, like, the Air Bud sequel that everyone's wanted.
He just starts doing trash.
Christopher Nolan.
Kangaroo Jack 2. Wild Hogs too.
Wild Hogs meets Scooby-Doo. Just an idea, guys.
I mean, thank you, man.
John Travolta wins the Oscar.
We're actually at the beginning of his next phase of his career, which is he makes absolutely terrible creative decisions and reboots terrible movies.
Oh, I'd love to see it. Yeah. Anyway, Chris, welcome on the show anytime.
And of course, for an interview, a chat.
Oh.
He always does these things where he shows people around a 60 perf IMAX film.
In his lair.
He has a lair.
Yeah. Anyway, that was a little chat about directors and directorial debuts. Let's get on with some emails now.
George, should we go through some of the emails that we get sent into the show every single week? As always, guys, if you wanted to send in your thoughts, your questions, your concerns, your reviews, your reckonings, your jokes, your musings,
your witticisms, your criticisms, your grumbles, your mumbles.
I like rhyming witticisms and criticisms there.
Thank you.
That's good. As always, you can send them in to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com.
Just
like Cameron did. Cameron writes into the show and says, hey guys, hope you're both well. Is there a way to find out which aspect ratio the film is shot in? So I know what to expect when going to the cinema and whether or not I need to ruin a cinema manager's day. Brackets, obviously joking. I'm very British and hate confrontation, so I normally just suck it up. Any help would be much appreciated. I may just jump in. Yes, there's a really great website called shotonwhat.com. Some of it's a little bit hard to understand if you don't know, but they do really useful information on camera it was shot on, lenses it was shot on, film stock, if applicable, and aspect ratio it was filmed in and presented in. So that's really useful if you do want to get into the nitty-gritty, especially when it comes to like digital upscaling of IMAX, if any of it is relevant to you. You could just type in like 1917 and it will say, okay, it was shot on the Arri Alexa Mini LF, presented in this format, and then it will go, that was also presented in a larger 1.43 to 1 IMAX, because they would have done two different releases. So that is a useful resource, which I often flick to. Yeah, shotonwhat.com.
Yeah, so maybe you mentioned that before, yeah.
Goes on to say, also completely different side note, have any of you seen the Boiling Point TV show on BBC iPlayer? It's the continuation of the film, which I know you spoke about on an episode a while back. I've recently finished it, and I have to say, I thought it was amazing. Incredible performances, great visuals and editing, and has an amazing way of conveying a lot of information to the audience about a character without having to do too much, i.e. loads of unnecessary dialogue and exposition. It's only 4 episodes, definitely recommend. Sorry for the long email and cheeky double question. Feel free to disregard. Big love and all the best. Cameron from London.
Thank you, Cameron. On the Boiling Point, which we both like the film, you are the first person to tell me that that is worth watching. I know some people who have watched it, couldn't finish it, didn't think it was very good. Mm. Obviously, it abandoned the one take thing. My sympathy is with that show because that film came out, they commissioned the series off the back of it. 6 months later, while they were clearly in production for it, The Bear comes out, becomes a global hit. God. 2 seasons of that came out before Boiling Point could even turn its head around.
Yeah.
And then that comes out and gets 4 episodes. It's a bit like, but I haven't seen it, no. This next email is from Will, who says, hey, James and George, friend of the show, Will here. So calling yourself, you are a friend of the show. I know who you are, Will, but thank you.
I'll call you a friend of the show.
You are always a friend of the show. I'll start off this email by saying that I've been loving listening to you ever since the Impressions on TikTok era and have been an avid listener ever since. I feel like it's a continuing era. We still do the Impressions. Yeah. It just rolls up, you know.
We've got to get more of those clips out, but yeah, thank you.
They're there. It's fair to say that now, whilst I came for the food, which I hope makes a comeback someday, I stayed for the great conversation and entertaining film chat. It really brightens up my morning walk to my lecture at 9 a.m. on a Friday. Oh, you're welcome, Will. Thank you. It's very nice.
The only thing I can imagine us doing is we do an editorial on the great food in cinema, great food. Ooh, scenes.
Stay tuned.
In cinema.
Maybe. Anyway, the message is in regards to 2 movies I watched this past weekend. I started as a high watching Challengers, and I must say that this was amazing. It was so entertaining and just an all-round easy watch that I found to be one of my favorites of the year so far whilst I was watching it. I honestly compared it to Top Gun Maverick, and it was just about how much I relaxed into the movie so easily. Yeah. I look forward to hopefully hearing a review on the pod. Yes, it came out last week, and hearing what you guys thought. My second review of the weekend was one you already reviewed and which I had similar thoughts on. That was Back to Black. Yes, Back to Black, reviewed a couple of weeks ago, the Amy Winehouse biopic. A movie that just happens and didn't really give me anything new and that I didn't think of except about the incident that happened afterwards. I will say that it was probably the most interesting part of the experience, as by the end of the film, 2 people were shouting at each other over the fact that one of them was talking through the entire movie. I thank them for making Back to Black cinema, the cinema experience of watching Back to Black somewhat bearable. That's damning, isn't it? The only memorable part of that film is the fact that 2 people had an argument.
Yeah, I do sort of... Oh, sorry, I'll let you finish.
I just want to say that
idea of Top Gun Maverick being really easy to immediately get into. It's like, that doesn't take away anything from it, that it's very approachable, like just soaking in, you're already into it, aren't you?
I also have a very warm, fuzzy feeling about Top Gun Maverick, which is not a film I've returned to yet because I kind of don't want to watch it on a small screen. Yeah. But it's because it was the first time, like I went to the premiere of it, but it was more that was the first time in the time that we'd done the show that there was like a movie event and you felt that everyone was in the world, was getting excited about a film, gone to see it and had gone to talk about it. And, you know, we had a lot of emails in and that was like really exciting from our point of view doing the show. And I also remember going to like the park and like talking to some friends about it and they were like, oh yeah, we've seen it. And I was like, oh, movies are back.
Yeah.
After COVID, movies are
big
back.
Big movies are back. Really nice. And then just on Back to Black, I mean, it's... what you say about it just didn't really give you anything at all. Unfortunately, it already being so clearly not true to that story, unfortunately, means it offers very little to its audiences.
And I've actually been surprised at how little, after the initial backlash when the film came out, how little that film has been talked
really
about. It just kind of goes to say that there's nothing really that film gives you.
Yeah.
Will finishes his email by saying, my hot take in this email is, which is already pretty long, he says, is that I actually kind of enjoyed Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom,
which is
the second one. Second they go one. To the island, it blows up, and they have the dinosaur auction. It has some great horror sequences and some of the set pieces involving the Indoraptor are really entertaining. It made me feel like more of a horror movie than an actual dinosaur movie. Sure, the clone subplot is meaningless and doesn't shock you at all. I still think it might be one of my favorites in the franchise. Hope that you have a great week and I look forward to more episodes of Pop
Kitchen.
Well,
I'm happy for you, but I will be confident to say you're alone. I think I think it's worse than World 3. Like, Dominion. Regarded, yes.
Yeah, but I didn't even get to Dominion.
I reviewed it, but just
you know, Jurassic World, which is like, it's fine, it's there, it's fine. It's okay. But I think, and stop me if I've said this before, but what was nice is that when I went to the cinema to see that, at the end, I thought, well, you know, Jurassic World, that was it.
I remember
that. Kid behind me, said, wow, that was the best movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I was like, that entire thing was worth it just for that kid's reaction.
You should have just shook him and screamed him. And
have you not seen the original, kid?
Go home. You're going to be like a scary old man. God damn you. Grab his mother and scream at her.
What are you doing bringing him here? He doesn't see the original.
Anyway, next time.
Because he hasn't, and he probably still hasn't.
No.
If their parents knew what was good, they'd go, oh, great, why don't we go and get...
9 years old.
Yeah, perfect for Jurassic Park 1.
He would have done his GCSEs by now. He'd be all grown up.
Oh, my God, he would be. Okay, he would have seen Jurassic.
He was 9 years old, but now he would have
done
it.
Now he would have done it.
Yeah, this was 9 years ago.
If you are that child...
If you went to the Brighton Odeon in the summer of 2015, in a, I want to say an afternoon screening, and sat on the center left block behind a man and a woman, and you saw, and you said to your mum at the end, that's the best thing you've ever seen. I was sat in front of you, and I hope you've seen the original Jurassic Park.
I hope we're here. This next one is from Laurie, who writes in about challenges and film clubs.
Yeah.
Says, Dear George and James, / James and George, Laurie here, compulsive listener, first time e-layer.
Oh, I like it, like you're addicted.
Gotta get my fix, man. I love listening to your passionate, informed, but informal movie discussions.
Thank you.
You guys are next in line to the film throne. Yes,
that's a nice little tagline. Informed, but informal.
Love it.
Oh, juicy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Movie discussions, brackets. You guys are next in line to the film throne held by our omnipotent leader, Mr. Kermode. You briefly met Mark Kermode.
I did recently. I had bumped into Mark Kermode when I was a teenager, and I think I told this story on the show before, but at the Fall Guy premiere, which was at the IMAX, which is a very strange, quite constrained location to have a premiere, but yeah, the BFI IMAX in London. We were going up the stairs actually at the same time, him and I. Mm. Nobody in front of us, nobody behind us. I was just like in good spirits talking to people. I was also there on my own as well. So I like was more easily able to cut in and out with people. And I just sort of turned to him and said, oh, hi, Mark. And he went, hi, in a way that, bless him, I know that look, he's a man, I think, in his early 60s, who I think probably, he's very competent. I'm not trying to say he's but like, I think it was clear in the way he said that he struggles to remember people's names. Meets a lot of people, doesn't remember their names, doesn't remember their faces. Maybe his eyesight's not too good. Mark, I love you. Not a problem at all. But I immediately said, hi, Mark. I shook his hand and said, oh, we don't know each other, but I just wanted to say that, you know, because of the podcast you do with Simon Mayo, it's been a huge inspiration. I actually have my own now with a friend of mine. And he was like, oh, that's great. And like, it was a very nice, pleasant interaction. And we had a little laugh. And I said something like, love the show, Steve, which is a little thing they say on Coming to Mayo. And then we parted ways. And I think he forgot about it instantly. It was a forgettable interaction. Even I forgot about it. I'm not thinking, he won't remember me, but like, it was just nice to be at an event where you can casually shake hands with
him. I reckon he is despite, you know, having that kind of interaction, I reckon he's the best type of famous.
Oh,
because
yes.
Also, the annoying part of it is I reckon a lot of people feel comfortable to go up to him and say, I just want to say, I love your stuff. I've been listening to you for years. You're an inspiration, blah, blah, blah. But also it's the kind of fame where nobody bothers you or is interested in anything actually going on in your life. Like, there's no demand to see him naked. There's no demand. There's no demand to like see him going to get groceries. Yeah. But when he's on holiday, out at a restaurant, walking around doing his thing, and in industry.
Also, this is in an industry capacity, so it's perfectly
industry
acceptable
capacity,
to go and
very
say
much
hello
so
to him.
He will just receive a lot of love and affection for what he's done over his career.
Yeah.
So that's the best. If you are going to chase fame, that's probably as good as you want it.
I will say, in the two interactions that I've had with him now over the space of 10 years, nice guy.
Yeah.
Nice guy, very genial and very, very open.
And I saw Simon Mayo like maybe a couple of months earlier, like right where Simon Mayo would be in London, in Radio City in Soho. He was walking with someone else. I was like, oh, hi, Simon.
And again, sorry, for our international listeners who don't know, who might not know Simon Mayo, Kermode are. They are the, you know, the godfathers of, well, he's the critic. Kermode's the critic, Mayo's the presenter, and they've, you know, been the godfathers of film,
broadcast, radio reviews,
for the past 20 years. We grew up in it.
Yeah.
And a huge influence. Anyway.
Sorry. Next one is...
We interrupted that email.
Laurie goes on to say, I am emailing after listening to George's review of Challenges. Please go and check
it was
our
also
review.
But
both of
our reviews.
But yes, I was there as well.
People either confuse us or just
forget I existed. I, for the most part, found it a sexy and slick watch that played a bit like a seductive but intelligent 90s Tom Cruise drama.
Yeah,
compliment.
I can kind of see that. Yeah,
however, I thought the ending, like O'Connor's character, committed a... The excessive slow-mo made the final scene unbelievable and silly, completely slicing the tension that had been built up by the movie's slick pacing, back-and-forth timeline, and the pumping pulse of the resonant Ross score. Most importantly, though, I found the final moment a complete cop-out that not only didn't make sense in terms of the blah, 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 but refused to make a meaningful comment on the themes it had opened up. Mm. I thought another current erotic thriller, Love Lies Bleeding, which George was less hot on, had a more committed ending, which being noticeably more divisive and auteur, at least had the confidence to stick to its cinematic guns.
Yeah, that's a fair comment about Love Lies Bleeding. Yeah. You and I did say about Challengers, we did think it just needed one more thing.
One more scene, or the ending is right on the edge of a little bit ridiculous. You know what? I have been warmed up to that
like
point.
Like a tennis match, it's like, is it on the line? You want it to be more definitively over one side of the line. Yeah, anyway.
Totally. Laurie goes on to say, I was introduced to your podcast by Will, my mate from uni, and one of our favourite things to do at uni was watch movies together. We now no longer live together, but, inspired partly by yourselves, have set up our own virtual two-man cinema club where we alternate choosing a movie for both of us to watch and then discuss. Regularly talking about movies has been a great way to continue a hobby we started together at uni. Some of our recent favourites have been Heat and Another Round, and some of our most divisive watches have been Dune Part 2 and Nolan's Forgotten Insomnia. Anyway, I was wondering if you would do us the honour in selecting the movie for our next little film. Club.
Oh, wow.
Ideally one which provokes interesting ideas and discussion, or perhaps one which divided the two of you. Keep up the great work. Laurie in Exeter, Sint from Mahoon, which I think is a reference
baby
to Baby Reindeer.
Oh, very good.
With different capitalized letters.
I love that's interpersonal film clubs. Great.
Yes.
And hello to your friend as well.
I've always loved catching up with friends about film. And although this is now sort of like its own beast, it is genuinely nice to not just speak to George about films, but to hear from people talking about films. It is the best. That's adorable. Okay. Okay, so George,
just one film, or is it a double bill?
Do us in selecting the next movie for our little film club. What if we do a directorial debut in honor of today's episode? I mean, we don't know what you've seen, or something that you.
Why don't you go and see Noah Baumbach's first movie, Kicking and Screaming, which I think is quite widely available but underseen.
Yes.
And let me know what you think.
And please do follow up with a review. That would be great.
Yeah, why don't you just go and do that? That's a good debut movie to go and watch. If not...
You want to James Acaster there?
That's a good movie to go and watch. Debut.
Kicking and screaming.
Made a debut. What I would just say is if that doesn't float your boat, choose one of the debut films that we've mentioned in the episode today.
That's
if
right,
you haven't seen those. Thank you so much, Laurie. That's a lovely email. This next email is from Calvin, who says, "Hey, James and George, Calvin from Manchester here. During the last episode, while talking about..." Oh, this is a few weeks ago now. "While talking about Back to Black, you discussed issues with the genre of musical biopics as a whole. I definitely agree that most musical biopics fall short for me. I just want to add in this point, there was a caveat to this, and which also actually proves my point. So even though I do think that genre is very tired and doesn't actually offer a lot cinematically, there is a very good musical biopic that is underseen. It would go into my underrated movies if I ever did it, called Love and Mercy with Paul Dano and John Cusack, which is about Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys.
I remember this film.
And
I
the reason this is a good musical biopic is not just that obviously we see Paul Dano as young Brian Wilson creating Pet Sounds, creating iconic Beach Boys music. It's because it's also about a very specific, unique thing that happened in Brian Wilson's life, which is that he became under the control and conservatorship of his manager, Eugene Landy.
Yeah.
So that's why it's not a textbook Bob Marley, Amy Winehouse, Rocketman, Bohemian Rhapsody kind of
thing.
Soon
to be Michael Jackson.
Soon to be Michael Jackson. It's like, oh yeah, this has a reason to exist because a very specific thing happened to him. Love and Mercy, great movie. Oh, no, that should be your film club, sorry.
Oh yeah.
Sorry. Laurie.
Scratch that, Laurie.
Laurie, come back. Laurie will. That's your movie. Love and Mercy, the Brian Wilson Beach Boys movie from 10 years ago. Go and watch
that. You can also do both and just...
You could just do both.
You got weeks, you've got to keep doing it.
We're not
going
to stop you. Yeah. Anyway, Calvin goes on to say, we were
you run to the outside house, Laurie.
We're sorry. We were recently cursed with the announced of the BC the Beatles Cinematic Universe.
God.
Four individual Beatles biopics helmed by Sam Mendes, all set to be released in 2027.
Did we talk about this on the
show
yet?
No, we didn't actually. So just people understand it. It's like one movie per Beatle told from their perspective, okay?
Yeah.
And you know, you're going to get a Paul, one a George, one a
George,
John, one
a Beatles Ringo. Fan.
Huge Beatles fan. So this pricked my, got my attention. As a big fan of the Beatles, I want these films to succeed but others have failed. So I'm curious what you think would make a truly great musical biopic of these, or do you think the BCU is doomed from the start? Thanks again for such an entertaining podcast.
BCU.
My wife, who never listens to the podcast, who never listens to podcasts, is now a dedicated listener. Shout out to Zoe.
Welcome, Zoe. Yes.
Thanks, Calvin. I will just say about the Beatles biopic.
We've only talked about this off air briefly.
So, I'm a big fan of the Beatles, and I was talking about it with my flatmate, who we share a love of the Beatles together. Yeah. And the thing is like, Sam Mendes is a competent director. I think he makes some great, good movies, some less so.
It's mixed.
He has made a mixed bag.
Empire of Lights is only as good as your last film, I think, which we both thought was really poor.
And I'm sure, you know, he'll have a lot of resources at his disposal. But the thing is like, Peter Jackson's Get Back documentary kind of already gives you everything that these films could possibly do, which is prime access, intimate access to the Beatles. The fact that Peter Jackson's Get Back has a scene in which you are hearing a true primary source conversation between John Lennon and Paul McCartney when they didn't know they're being recorded. That is as close to being in the room or a fly on the wall as you can get. So I don't know what a kind of fictionalized version or, you know, a broad brush studio version can give you. It makes me a little bit depressed and cynical. Peter Jackson's Get Back is a test. It's 9 hours long. It's not for everyone, but getting through it, I thought it was amazing. But that's how I feel about it.
On one hand, I go, oh, great, time, four different options, opportunities to tell the story, flesh it out, give it the time it deserves, one of the greatest music artists of all time. But I'm also like, that's a lot of time for things to go wrong, for things to change, for a lot of things to not be accurate and true. So I'm like...
And also for appetites to change amongst... Like, look at like the Dark Universe, you know, with the Universal when they couldn't launch that, you know, with the Mummy, or the Divergent series, which they didn't even finish. It's a long time to commit to a project. That's why they don't make Boyhoods every year. Because it's a real commitment.
It's not possible.
And then
this last one is from Sanjeev, who says, well, hello, James/and/or George. This has become...
James and. Or.
But we're always together.
So it's either James and George, George and James, doesn't matter. Anyway.
This has become my favourite podcast in such an astonishingly short amount of time. You've really nailed the balance between critical breakdown and hilarity, so kudos. If you'll indulge me, I have two questions for both of you.
Go for it.
What is your take on IMDb ratings? Mm. I'm well and truly a sucker for being snobby and only entertaining a movie if it's a 7+ when I'm flicking through the streaming service. Upon self-reflection, I've realised an unexpected amount of movies I love do not meet this criterion. For example, 2014's Comet is a flawed but beautiful movie which just nails that feeling of longing and nostalgia. With a big pinch of salt.
Yeah, I mean, basically with a big pinch of salt. It's a good
question.
We've
covered Rotten Tomatoes, Metacritic.
My brother's girlfriend, when I first met her, was like, treated IMDb ratings as the gospel. Yeah. And I had to be like, well, no, because those are voted for. I think we all agree, taking a pinch of salt and an indicative look at all of the ones, not just IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, Letterboxd, using that a little bit to gauge your opinion, but don't let it inform your
opinion. It's a score. It's a mathematical score.
But deeply cynical-wise, yes, if a film is under 7 on an IMDb, I'm like,
are films that I think are great that have 50-60 percentage on Rotten Tomatoes, and that's not because it's bad, it's because it's divisive.
Yes.
So a divisive film will naturally score lower than an average film that is not divisive.
Yeah, and also, like, the law of averages, the more people review a movie, the lower
the more likely
the score
to
is.
A negative review than a good review. Goes on to say, what are the key things you are looking for in a good cinema? I've gone through this journey of being amazed by an everyman, having fun with the vibe of Curzon, getting a kick out of the massiveness of the IMAX at the Waterloo roundabout, and falling in love with Portobello Electric Cinema. Great. Personally, question. I fell in love with an oldie world cinema in Nottingham called the Savoy purely because of the intangible vibe. Thank you so much for keeping me company whilst I'm coding. Best regards, Sanj.
Great question.
Touched on this.
Great question. But if you would say, like, dream scenario, best cinema auditorium, I think what I would say would be, first of all, impeccable pitch quality and impeccable
sound.
The sound has to be great. Also, the acoustic separation from the auditorium and the outside of the rest of the cinema. Mm. I don't want to hear the rumble from the next screen. Mm. I don't want to hear the murmur of people in the foyer. I don't want the door when people come into the auditorium to be too loud.
That,
I don't want the shh as it comes through. You know, the
and when the door gets stuck and now it's you know what my thing is.
I don't want to see people coming into the cinema in my eye line. I want the entrance to be behind me.
Yeah.
I want wherever I sit for my awareness of other punters to be minimized.
You know what I like? I like a steep auditorium.
A steep, yes.
To me, steep auditoriums. When you've been to some, I think there's a multiplex in Cambridge where the screen is there and it's a fine screen, but it's like flat.
Yeah.
And I see every motherfucker getting their popcorn, taking their coat off, chatting thing. I see all of it. Yeah. And I remember I watched The Martian there and I saw it all through 60 heads.
Yeah, no, it's not good.
No good. Steep auditorium. Let them
curved.
Curved. Let it. So great cinema. The IMAX is curved to match the curvature of your face.
But also, a curved auditorium as well.
Oh, curved auditorium too. Yes, great screens. They match the curvature of your eyes on your face, and it actually fully immerses you. But also, steep auditorium solves a lot of problems.
I also think that there's the cinema I grew up with, which is now a deluxe version of a very famous multiplex cinema chain.
Yeah.
When they revamped that cinema, they had fewer seats in the cinema than they did before. They took out half the seats, but they made all of the seats incredibly comfortable and spaced out. So they are at a steep. There is a rake, and there's a lot of space. So it's kind of great for you because you never feel like you're in amongst a lot of people. And then the fewer people, the less chance of disruption. And it's a great amount of separation. So,
We're very lucky. We live in London, so we have access to cute boutique-y multiplex, big IMAX. Yeah. But obviously,
no cooked food. No bringing in hot dinner. Sorry, every man. No. I don't want that.
Don't bring in a curry.
I've seen it happen.
We know what I like about sort of boutique-y ones is that I've realized it's not just about the screen size, because the screen on average is smaller at a sort of boutique upmarket one. But when you're actually raised and you're quite close to the screen, that's quite a good effect. I saw The Killer like that, and I was really glad I saw it.
Makes a huge amount of difference is the height of the ceiling. So there's a Curzon near me, very comfortable, good acoustic separation, comfortable seats goes without saying as well.
Yeah.
But you're in a low ceiling, so you do feel like you're in basically a screening room. So you're very much aware of everyone around you. Whereas if you have a higher ceiling, a bit more like a typical auditorium.
That's how sound bounces, isn't it?
Yeah, a typical auditorium. You feel less like you're in each other's pocket. You're less likely for the chew of popcorn to bounce around the walls.
When you walk into the BFI IMAX, something about it feels like walking into a cathedral.
Oh yeah, the cathedral effect. We talked about it before.
Yeah, because it is three, four stories high?
Yeah.
So you really are about to experience this, like a concert. Yeah.
Yes.
Like when I saw what's the face in
Stop Making Sense.
Yeah, Stop Making Sense in the IMAX. Oh, I'm like, brilliant. This shouldn't make sense, but here it is. I really do feel like I'm at a concert, and it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Great. Sorry, we could talk about cinemas and screenings forever.
But we just disappeared into cinema heaven in the movies in our mind.
Ideally, I'd love to design my own multiplex where I have access to all of these different types of spaces.
Yeah.
Like the event one and then a cute one.
It was funny. Sorry, you just mentioned seeing Stop Making Sense in IMAX. I do sometimes have to pinch myself and look back and be like, if you asked me a year ago, I think someone did, what's the film, number one film I'd like to see in IMAX? It would have been that film.
Yeah.
And I had such a great experience. I'm like, that was such a dream come true for me.
Yeah. You saw it three times.
When it came re-released, I saw it three times.
You got your money's worth out of that.
Absolutely.
Release,
and to be honest, if you told me right now that tickets on sale for the IMAX again.
You do it.
I'd probably do it, yeah.
I love that.
It's incredible.
Well, guys, that's all the emails we have. Well, guys, those are all the emails that we have time for. Thank you, as always, for sending them in. If you have any questions, thoughts, concerns, musings, reviews,
mumbles and bumbles and grumbles,
send them into hello@popkitchenpodcast.com, and we would love to read them out on the show. George, as always, let's end
with a game.
With a game.
Yay! Sorry, last week, we didn't play a game last week because we were trying, there was a lot of things to talk about.
I know
a couple of people commented saying, we're sorry, guys. We are sorry, but we've got a good game for you today, haven't we?
I'm still going to say it. George, as always, Pop Kitchen ends
with a game.
Back by popular demand. You guys really like this game. This is the sound game where I'm going to play. I think I've got 11 sound clips.
Aren't we lucky?
From films. George has to guess. I'm going to play him a line of dialogue, a piece of score, a sound effect, any combination of those from films. And George has to guess, with only hearing 3 seconds of the audio, what film it is from. George, I'd like to ask you, when I play the sound, not to say it immediately, so to just give... This is great to play along with at home.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just listen and try and figure out the sound. Maybe I'll play it and I can go, George, do you have it? And you can go, yes. And then I'll let you say, just because I want people at home to be able to play as well. And of course, play along at home. They start easier and they get incrementally more difficult, not in exact order, but because how do I gauge that? They're about 3 seconds long, both for difficulty and for copyright infringement reasons, which I assume would be there. So I think I'm just going to hover on the algorithm's radar there. George, are you ready?
I'm ready.
For your first clip. You have to guess the film from this sound. Hold on, I just want to sort my sound out. Just make sure this is all loud enough. Okay, George, yes, are you ready?
Yes.
You have to guess the film from this sound, starting with an easy one.
No! You must not read from the book!
Do you have it?
I do have it.
What film is that from?
That is from The Mummy. Stephen Sommers' Mummy, the Brendan Fraser Mummy, which is brilliant.
A childhood favourite of ours.
Yatue, Yatue, Yatue.
It is... No! It is the awakening of Imhotep, and you see this freeze frame of the mummy, and it's like, he wakes up. I've never woken up like that.
No.
Like,
are you having enough coffee? Great sleepover movie.
Oh, that's really good shout.
Yeah, great sleepover movie.
A bit of horror for kids as well.
Yeah, perfect.
Lovely. That was the first sound. That's one I know George knows, just to get the game going. You must not read from the book. Are you ready for your second sound?
I'm ready.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
George.
I have it.
Yes.
It's Die Hard.
Yes.
Famously. Great, one of the best lines in the movie.
One of the great lines. One of actually the iconic images from Die Hard in the vent, squinting with a lighter crawling through.
Perfectly captures the whole movie because it's like funny, humor, but like also very serious. He's literally in like a very serious situation, stuck in the vent. But
talking to himself.
And I remember watching that movie with my dad when I was younger, and like he would always laugh at that. And I'm like, oh, that's a joke that grown-ups like. So this is a sensible movie.
Yes.
Because grown-ups get it.
One more time for people to hear.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
Bruce Willis.
Brilliant.
Love him. George, are you ready for your third sound?
Let's do it.
You have to guess the film from just this sound.
There it is! There it is! There's the Did It Beetle! Yes!
George, do you have it?
I do have it.
Yes.
That is
the voice of
Jim Carrey in The Truman Show.
Yes.
When he's got Laura Linney in the car and when he's starting to realize things are going strange.
They just go around and around. He goes full Ace Ventura.
Yeah, he does. It comes out. Yeah.
It really comes out. He's very subdued for most of it. But
that is a film I'm very, very keen to do a rewatch of soon. I don't know. I'm just starting to realize that I haven't seen it in a long time and I do love it. That's Jim Carrey messaging in now.
That is Jim Carrey saying, oh! Just one more time for people who didn't hear.
There it is! There it is! There's the Did It Beetle! Yes!
Sounds a little bit like Tom Cruise at the beginning of that. There it is!
Yes,
very intense.
Could be.
90s
could be.
Intense. Let's go next.
Lovely. The next film. George, are you ready?
Ready.
That was loud. Okay, we're going to play that one more time. Getting a bit harder now. Sound again. Is it familiar to you, George?
Oh, that last little strings bit is, I think.
Yeah, so...
So, okay, can you go, Dune?
No.
Amazing Spider-Verse?
No. Oh. I'll play it one more time. Do you have it at home?
E.T.
No. You did E.T. last week.
All right. No, I don't have it.
Okay, so you know this film, you like this film, you've seen this film. It is a very disturbing film with a very famous score, which I'm playing. Okay, I'm going to tell you. That is the score from the final scene in Hereditary.
Oh,
and it goes on. It's an amazing... I really don't know that, so I'll play the rest of it for you, sis. The film is in like pure peak at that moment.
Next.
Great film, great scene.
Also, another debut. That was his debut film, Ari Aster.
Oh my gosh, yeah, how have you not
seen that? He made lots of short films before that, but yes, Hereditary, a great debut film.
George, are you ready for your next?
This topic is just a gift that keeps on giving.
You enjoying it? You having fun?
I'm loving it.
You having fun at home? Ready for your next sound?
I'm ready.
You have to guess the film from just this sound.
Other than that, I'm in good shape.
Yes.
That is Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone.
Yes, it is the iconic aftershave.
Yeah, aftershave, thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and screaming.
Yeah.
Sensitive little baby cheeks.
Yeah.
One more time.
Other than that, I'm in good shape.
It's the moment where he's like, he's by himself, but he's actually being very responsible. Yeah. He's like, I've been washed and bathed and washed all my crevices in between my toes. I'm feeling good and I'm in good shape.
Yeah, I thought at first it was Abigail Breslin in Little Miss Sunshine.
Oh yeah,
next.
Alas, nay. George, are you ready for your next clip?
Let's do it.
Hopefully these are getting harder.
Which number is this?
Don't know.
They can only watch as the ice claims their egg and the life within it.
The distinctive voice of
Morgan Freeman.
Unforgettable.
Never seen this. This is March of the Penguins.
March of the Penguins. I thought I'd throw a little documentary in there.
Well, I was just like, Morgan Freeman, clearly a documentary. What's he done? March of the Penguins.
So obviously only Morgan Freeman's voice, but a very sad moment when, you know, they have to part, the penguins have to pass the eggs between their little sacks. And if it touches the floor for 1 second, the egg freezes. And it's the moment where the two penguins that mate for life realize that their egg has frozen.
They can only watch as the ice claims their egg and the life within it.
And they're both like with their heads down, like their beaks, very sad. March of the Penguins. March of the Penguins. Okay, are you ready for your next clip?
I am.
Ready?
We were both born in the same hospital.
1921.
7 days apart.
In the same hospital.
George?
That's one of the intercutting old couples in When Harry Met Sally.
Yes. Well, I think such a great scene. I found a YouTube video which had like all of them cut together. And they're really well done. They're really well acted.
They're brilliant.
One more time.
We were both born in the same hospital.
1921.
7 days apart.
In the same hospital.
And they're just like the layering of the dialogue.
We both grew up one block away from it.
We both lived in tenements.
They're all talking, it's classic old couple. Brilliant, love it.
Just not really, they're like together as one entity, not really talking to each other. George, are you ready for, George, are you ready for your next clip?
Yes, I am.
Inspector Hank. By order of the Commissioner of Police of Broca Province, I hereby place you under arrest for the murder of Madame Celine Villeneuve de Goffin Taxis.
That is Edward Norton in the Grand Budapest
Hotel.
Yes,
very well done.
I immediately recognised his voice, and I thought, that's a ridiculous name, so it's a comedy.
Humming score.
And I thought, oh yeah, he plays the police. Yep, got that. Yeah.
One more time.
Inspector Hank. By order of the Commissioner of Police of Broca Province, I hereby place you under arrest for the murder of Madame Celine Villeneuve de Goffin Taxis.
Yeah. Madame Celine Villeneuve of Goffin Taxis. Such a Wes Anderson name to have thrown into a film. Okay, George, you're doing very well.
Thank you.
Are you ready for your next sound? You've got three more.
Let's do it.
You have to guess the film from this sound.
He was John because he was John.
He was John because he wrote Ticket to Ride.
That is Steve Jobs.
Yes.
That's Seth Rogen in the auditorium, Steve Jobs on the... Michael Fassbender, Steve Jobs.
Acknowledge the Apple II team. Yeah. And it's a reference to something they made earlier about creativity and creation and John and Paul.
And the Beatles. The Beatles.
The Beatles. One more time for people who wanted to hear that.
He was John because he was John.
He was John because he wrote Ticket to Ride. And I wrote the Apple II.
Everybody, look, I want to clear
nobody
you
out. Nobody moves.
Voice of Sarah Snook, I think, coming in.
Yes, there. She's it is. Sarah Snook's in there. I rewatched that film
at the moment,
6 months ago.
I'm only one down.
Which one didn't you go? Hereditary.
Let's see if we can complete this.
These ones are harder. Ready? For your final, to your second last sound. I'll play that one more time.
I mean,
nothing.
Got too big for my boots there, didn't I?
The clue is in the sound, which isn't very helpful to say.
So it's a machine gun? Or, no, it's a car.
Oh, that's warm.
Car. It's a truck, a vehicle, a lorry.
Hello.
A car.
It is a car.
It's a car, and there's a lot of time spent in the car.
Let's play it again. Our older listeners will be screaming into their phones.
No, I don't got it, mate.
What's the sound?
It's the exhaust. I don't know. It's the sound of the motor, the engine.
Make the sound again.
Ticket, ticket, bop. Ticket, ticket, ticket. Ticket.
Chitty chitty bang bang. I love that you were saying.
I don't speak exhaust, okay?
Chitty
I don't
chitty
speak car.
Chitty chitty bang bang.
Oh, that's very good. That's so obvious.
What a funny noise it's making.
I love that you made the sound. That really entertained me.
Thank you.
Okay, George, are you ready for your last sound? This is hard, but I can't tell if you'll get it based on just, you know,
all
things.
Right, let's do it.
Ready? Final sound. You have to guess the film from just this sound.
Okay, come on. Come on. Come on.
5 seconds you got there. Is it familiar?
I need it again.
Yeah, I'll play it for you again. Todd.
Yeah.
Okay, come on. Come on.
Beautiful score.
Is that the voice of Michelle Williams?
No. But you're on the right kind of lines in terms of... But you're on the right lines in terms of vibe.
Am I in the right era? You know, Michelle Williams.
Okay. Sure, yeah.
Come on, come on. Okay, the guy's laughing. The guy's not Bruce Willis. No. And the guy's laughing because it's the end of the movie.
No. Famously, no.
Beginning.
Famously not the end of the movie.
Come on. Is there a dog involved?
Don't think so.
God.
Play it for you one more time.
Okay, come on. Come on. Come on.
If you were to get it, it's hard, but if you were to get it, it would be from the score triggering a memory from a film.
The 90s. Is it from the 90s?
No.
The noughties?
No.
The 80s?
No.
The 2010s?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's tricky, but like,
is it an emotional film? It's really sad.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. Obviously.
Somebody died.
It's probably the most beautiful scene of the film. People are a little bit mixed on it, but it's undoubtedly beautiful with great performances.
Oh, God. Oh, have I seen it?
Yes.
Have I talked about it on the show?
We've talked about it actually somewhat recently within 4 or 5 episodes. Not extensively, but you know, like, it's come up, and I'll play it for you again. No, if you don't get it, it's hard.
Okay, come on. Come on. Come on.
The score, it's a beautiful moment. It's a really beautiful moment in the film.
You have to tell me.
Okay, it is the scene in The Place Beyond the Pines. When Ryan Gosling and Eva Mendes are playing with the baby, and it's this moment of real sort of like emotional clarity and happiness before he then goes on to do what he does in that film. And the score in that entire, first of all, it's beautifully shot, and the interaction between them, who are obviously really in love, is so tender and sweet. And I'll drag it out a bit. And he's sort of like laughing, and he's got the ice cream with the kid.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that is obscure.
It's super obscure.
But I like the fact you did it because it's a significant moment. I do remember the score from that movie being like... Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
Dun. Derek Chanfrance hasn't made a movie in a while. I'd like to see him do more.
Yeah.
But they're very good. I wouldn't have got that, but I enjoyed the tease.
Nice little tease, and like if you that's often regarded as like the best scene in that film.
Yeah.
Beautiful interactions between actors and
Gosling
in a real sort of sexy look there. The ripped off sleeves.
Yeah, bad boy Gosling.
Bad boy Ken. Really.
Yeah, bad boy Ken.
We made that joke when we saw Barbie that it's kind of Place Beyond the Pines look.
Someone just commented, they were like, "Yeah, it's the same actor with the same hair."
No, it's the same kind of raw energy.
The fringing.
I contest that.
Well, thank you, James, for that. I enjoyed that.
That was the sound game. And I'd like to hear if you got any of these as fast as George, or got the ones that George didn't get.
This concludes our episode today. And that concludes our broadcast today. You've made it to the end of episode 127. Thank you guys for staying with us. And thank you for listening. It's been a really interesting episode. We've really enjoyed talking
really
about
enjoyed
something
it.
Different for a change. We'll be back next week as ever. Please continue to follow us on social media as you always do, because we'll be posting interviews we're doing with directors
and
cast.
On our Instagram story.
Yeah, we put
Let's
out
do fun things.
The whole point of today, all the questions we ask on
Film
Instagram.
Bites coming out that doesn't come out on the show. All of those are good fun.
It's great.
It's like thousands of comments on some of those videos. So go get involved.
If you're not plugged in and signed up and subscribed to our Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Spotify, etc., please do it. And if you wouldn't mind, if you're listening to this on Spotify, just rating us 5-star at the top, it really helps us as well.
Yeah,
and just share it
and
with
subscribe.
Your friends.
Subscribe to something of ours,
like,
please.
Subscribe,
it makes a huge difference
comments.
To us being able to do this.
Yeah,
we really appreciate it.
We love doing
Pop Kitchen comes out every single Wednesday,
and we love hearing from you. Thank you so much. That's it, isn't it?
Take care.
Bye bye. Have a great
week.
Bye bye.